I think. Okay, be better if we did this outside. Anyway, this project that I'm going to tell you about that we're working on really started because Dave Waits asked Tom Lubinsky and I once to write a list of the top 10 problems in soft matter physics. And the first one we came up with was life. Okay, so the question was, okay, from soft matter, can we make life? And actually, I used to associate this quote with Stan Leibler, but it really came from my freshman physics teacher that what you can't understand, you don't understand. What you can't create, you don't really understand. So if we're going to do biology, I thought, you know, we ought to be able to create it. And the question is, are we at a stage yet where we can actually make something which does the most fundamental things in biology, which is self-replicate, with maybe the ability to evolve and stuff like that. So the question we sort of asked ourselves is, what's the simplest self-replicating system we can make? Can we make such a system with the possibility that, you know, it can evolve, so it's not just one molecule which replicates itself, but a process, sort of a general process for replication. It's interesting for lots of aspects, not just biology. You know, if you're going to do nanotechnology and you want to make zillions of copies of something on a nanoscale so that it's macroscopic, you don't want to do it one by one. You want to have it exponentially grow, and that's one of the projects here. And the question is, can we do this yet? And the answer is, well, sort of. The idea that we started with was doing it on a colloidal scale, with the main advantage being that on a colloidal scale, you can see exactly what's going on as it's going on in real time. You can visualize it, you can see it, you can control it and stuff like that. I'm going to talk, I don't know, I hope only about half the time about the work we're doing with colloids, which recognize one another because they have DNA attached. They're functionalized with DNA on their surface, and hence they can recognize one another specifically, irreversibly. The system that we have that was based on the ideas we got from the colloids, which actually does work, and I think, in fact, it's the first system, artificial system, that does self-replicate. That is, you put in an arbitrary seed, you go through a process, and you end up with copies of that seed, okay? And that's based on DNA tiles. The functionality, as I'll show you, is essentially the same as for the colloids. And the problem with them is, as you can see from this image, is that you can't see them real time. You have to see them under an AFM. So these are actually tiles. They are 20 nanometer tiles. Oops. 20 nanometer tiles strung together here. They're like encoded here, A and B, or red and green. There's essentially, they're a two-letter alphabet, and here's a seven-letter word that we make. These are 20, 24 nanometers each. They're strung together in this word. The initial seed is like this. They're labeled, in this case, with streptavidin, so you can read the word in an AFM. That's the seed. Here are the daughters. Here are the granddaughters. And that works. It's laborious, but it works so far. Now, these are all DNA. These are DNA on colloidal particles, micron-sized colloidal particles. We realized as soon as we started that everybody would yell, "Foul, you're cheating," because you're using DNA and everybody knows that DNA self-replicates. Of course, it's not true. DNA doesn't self-replicate. It needs a big enzyme to come along and stitch it together and take it apart and do things like that. Nonetheless, we realized there would be a problem convincing people that we've done something, so we wanted another system that could could have recognition and could also reversibly and irreversibly bind. And so what we came up with is another idea that we stole from biology, which is from proteins, lock and key particles. So these are colloidal particles which have mouths in them, and they bind only to complementary particles which fit in the mouth. Okay? And hopefully that will allow us to get rid of DNA for recognition, for specific recognition. Okay, here are some of the people who are involved. It's a lot of people from the soft matter group at NYU. Grierstein, Peen, Ned Seaman, and most of the work is done by, was initially done by Miriam and Remy, and a host of postdocs and students over here. And their names will come up as we go along. So basically the idea was to take particles that would recognize their complements. The easy way to do that is to take colloidal particles, coat a red particle with a particular DNA sequence on the end. We call these sticky ends on the end of a double strand over here, which is fairly rigid. The red particle won't bind to itself. It will only bind to its complement, which is this green strand over here, complementary single strand of DNA, which will hybridize. We were told reliably by, by biologists and biophysicists they knew that this was really, really easy. And the reason it was supposed to be really, really easy is because you can buy everything, right? So you can buy colloidal particles with streptavidin. This is nutravidin as a form of streptavidin. That's the brand by Molecular Probes. It's one of several companies that will sell you colloids with streptavidin on the surface. You can buy from a bunch of companies for under $100 with overnight delivery up to 100 bases coming out this way, a strand of single-stranded DNA, okay, attached with a little polymer linker which makes it flexible, and biotin at the end which will bind to the streptavidin over there. You don't even have to think about it. You can ask what the energy of interaction is of these oligomers that you're going to single-stranded oligomers that you're going to bind together to make a double strand to hybridize. You just go to one of another bunch of websites, you type in the particular sequence you've got, and it will spit out for you what the melting temperature is. So this is all supposed to be really easy. The thing that really makes it work is across the street. Actually, he's not here yet, right? He's speaking tomorrow, so I won't give you big advertisements for Ned Seaman. Who's in chemistry at NYU, who pointed out that DNA is not merely the secret of life, but you could actually do something with it. It's actually useful, okay? You got the Kavli Prize last year. What's that?
Unlike life, which is useless.
Yeah, unlike life, which is useless. Which is a good reason to start over again, is what I thought. People have worked with DNA on colloids before, and it really started with Chad Merkin, who showed you could take nanogold particles and link them together with DNA. They'll change color, and you could use that as an indicator for presence of DNA and RNA. And John Crocker was sort of one of the first ones to start on micron-size colloids, but now at NYU and Harvard at Penn, there are several groups that are working on it. What it looks like to scale is something like this. There's a polystyrene sphere, which is typically maybe a micron in diameter. These little DNAs are like hairs on the surface. There may be, we're using 50 bases in a double helix and 11 base sticky end over here. It sticks out about 15 nanometers from the surface. So it really is essentially a surface interaction. And the interaction is governed by essentially how many of these sticky ends can contact from one sphere to the other when they come together. Okay, all this stuff was supposed to work very well, and the problem is it didn't, okay? Things stuck together that weren't supposed to stick together, and things that were supposed to stick together and when you heat them up come apart, didn't come apart, right? And the reason essentially is because it's essentially what you know from colloidal physics, that the big problem is colloidal stabilization. You can't let the surfaces get close together, or you'll never get them apart. And it's known from biology as well. This just shows you sort of what the potential looks like. The DNA potential is actually very easy to characterize. This is a repulsive interaction. There's van der Waals, which attracts you very strongly at short distances. And essentially, this straight line here is essentially what the interaction between particles due to the DNA is. It's simply how many DNA strands. Oops, I've got to be careful with this guy. Now I've got it here. There you go. Oops, I want to go back one. It's essentially linear. It's essentially how many different bonds you can form, and that essentially goes with the separation, linearly with the separation of the surfaces. So below the melting temperature, you get an attractive interaction, which is like this straight line over here, okay? And above the melting temperature, you essentially get zero. So you don't want to have this strong enough that you go over this bump. It's also something that everybody in biology knows. Oops, I've got to get this guy right. Specific interactions are very easy to get in biology. What's really hard to prevent is non-specific interactions. And that's what a lot of biology is about. So that's what we had to do. I won't belabor the point. What we did is we put, here are the DNA double strands with the sticky ends. What we did is we put a surfactant, a pleuronic, on the tri-block copolymer on the surface, which essentially sticks out, the hydrophilic part sticks out about this length, and that prevents the DNA from one particle reaching the surface of the other. Once you do this, you have a system which is in fact specific. Red never sticks to red or green to green. They'll only stick together if you've got an intermediate particle between them. And this cycles like crazy. This thing shows you heating and cooling cycles, and they aggregate and disaggregate as you cool down and heat up and cool down and heat up. And so now you've got a system that you can really do this reproducibly with. Okay. And the cycle time is just essentially diffusion limited in most cases. It's just essentially DLA. So that's Schmalkowski. Self-replication. So I love this slide here because people have thought about self-replication before. I really love the Penrose family. Not so much Roger, but his father over here, Lionel, was incredible. A grandmaster chess, he's a mathematician. He worked on fingerprints. I use this stuff when I talk about dye-block copolymers. He also tried to think about making something that would self-reproduction. What's interesting about this paper, which is from the early 50s, which is Nature, it says, it happened that my colleague Roger Penrose mentioned that. This is Roger when he's like 12 years old. Right, a kid, right? His son. He doesn't even mention that his son here, right? And they decided to see whether they could make something mechanical that would self-replicate. They came up with these bumpers, which sit in a slider like this, okay? You slide back and forth like that. They bump into one another and nothing happens. You put two of them together like that and you slide it, and this one rides up on that and they link together, and you slide it back and they're all linked, okay? Now, they realized immediately, okay, this isn't really self-replication or it's crystallization. And crystallization is different. If you have replication, you want something where you start out with a certain amount of material, you double it or triple it, whatever, in a cycle, and then you exponentially grow it as you go through cycles. And something that crystallizes grows algebraically, okay? So that doesn't work, and they understood that. One of the suggestions they made in here, which is an old suggestion, is that if you start crystallizing something, you can start it crystallizing, you take a hammer, and you can smash it after 20 minutes and get lots of little crystallites, right? You let them grow, 20 minutes later you smash all of those, and that will grow exponentially, right? But it won't do what we want it to. That is, for instance, if there's a mistake, okay, it won't replicate the mistake. A defect won't be replicated. So it won't do what we want, and it's tiresome after a while smashing these crystals. Okay, they did a great job though. They actually came up with sliders that fit together this way. When you rock it that way, okay, they only replicate. Okay, they only replicate themselves. You put it the other way, they slide it that way. Here you get two replicas of it, right? They said, this isn't so good, we can only do two things. If we go into the second dimension, we can stack them together, and now we can get as many as we want. And they actually built these things, right? They actually built these guys, right? And they actually showed you could do it. That won't work for exponential growth very well. This is a machining job. So we need another technique other than the technique that they use. So here's the basic idea of what we want to do. Here's a seed. They're colloidal particles. They're held together, the initial seed is held together permanently by DNA, which is permanently bound here, and I'll tell you how you can do that in a minute. It's got DNA which sticks up, which is associated with A and B like that. You put it in a soup. Oops. You put it in a soup of complementary particles, actually of all particles. The only thing that will associate here is the complementary particles. Once they've assembled, that's easy. This is really easy. Getting the particles to assemble is really easy. The trick is how you make this permanent. So the idea we had is we'll have another different strand of DNA going in the transverse, in the longitudinal direction here. I'll call this transverse, this longitudinal, okay? And if you can permanently cross-link these, which we're going to do by shining on light, which will cross-link it, okay, then you can heat it up, it'll dehybridize, and you've got a copy. Okay, so that's the basic idea that we want to use. We want to cycle temperature and light. I should say that the reason we started out this way, rather than doing what biology does now, which is to work all at constant temperature with enzymes, is we want to do without enzymes. We wanted the simplest system. And to a physicist, if you want something to respond periodically, there is nothing like driving it periodically. Right? So the idea was we'll drive this with a cycle, temperature and light. Okay? That was the idea. Making the seeds is easy. You just grab your red and green particles, which here are black and white, with tweezers, and you can assemble them in any form that you want. Here, for instance, is one assembled as a paddle. And after you cross-link it, it's now just the permanent seed of any shape you want and whatever design you want in it. But you can make the initial seed so it doesn't have to form, right, automatically. Your seed is made artificially, and that's what you want to replicate afterwards. Okay, so how can you do this? What you'll do is, the easy thing is these transverse interactions. That's sort of what I showed you before. What you have is just Watson-Crick pairs, a particular sequence of bases over here, the complementary bases on the A prime particle, separately ones for B and B prime, so B prime will come down on B. But now, since you've got an arbitrary sequence this way, you want on this strand for the longitudinal interactions, you want A prime to be able to bind with B prime, or A prime with A prime, or B prime with B prime, etc. Right? So you want that not to be specific. You just want to make sure it doesn't bind to your unprime particles. So what you use for that is a palindrome. That's what we decided to use. A palindrome in language is a word that reads backwards the same as it reads forwards, right? In DNA, it's not that. It's, if you read it backwards, it's the complement of what you read when you read it forward, okay? So this sticky end over here will stick to itself, right? So that will mean if I have an A here and an A here, it'll bind. If I have an A here and a B here, it'll bind, as long as they have the same palindrome on them. That doesn't make it permanent. In order to make it permanent, what we wanted to do is use something which would cross-link with ultraviolet. So we were told by everybody in biology that sorolin, which intercalates between thymine-adenine pairs over here, if you have TA, AT like that, this will intercalate between them, and when you shine on UV, it will covalently cross-link the thymines, right? So we tried that for about a year or two, and it's junk. It cross-links like 15% of the time, So it's not very good and it's not very specific. We had to develop for that our own chemistry, and we came up with cinemates. Cinemates can be put in a DNA backbone like that. This molecule you can put in, it goes in instead of one of the bases, and when you shine UV on this, this double bond opens up and cross-links in one of two ways. So now you can put that linker in your strand like that. You can shine on UV, and that cross-links great. And this just shows it to you. Oops, I keep on going the wrong way with this. This shows it to you. These guys over here are just Watson-Crick pairs. You heat them up, they come apart. Here what you do is you have a Watson and a Watson, not complementary strands, but with the cinemate in it, held together by a palindrome so that these guys are within like 5 nanometers of one another. And I'll show this again to you. These guys don't form a bond. When you shine on the UV, they should come apart. These guys, where you have either in a palindrome or in a Watson-Crick pair, these cinemates, when I shine the light on and heat it up, these guys should stay together. These guys should come apart. So I'll just show that to you again. So here are the particles agglomerated, condensed. That light was the UV that was shined on, and now you heat it up. This guy comes apart. This guy comes apart. This doesn't come apart, right? So this stuff really works. It's actually kind of neat. You can also use it for photolithography. So we wrote NYU on a surface. That was just the first attempt to show you could do it. That's not so interesting here. Understanding the physics of it. Unfortunately, we got involved in trying to understand the physics of what goes on. DNA melts. It's essentially a mini-phase transition, because when you bind DNA, when you hybridize it, the enthalpy you gain from the hydrogen bonds, you also lose the configurations of your separate single strands when you hybridize them together. So at some temperature, this free energy is zero, and they won't bind. And below that temperature, you can have an enormous binding energy. So you're not you can be bound, you can lower the temperature 10 and be bound by 1,000 KT. That's the way DNA and stuff works. This is nuclear physics, the session, right? So in fact, we actually used radioactivity in order to measure the amount of DNA that we have on our particles. We do everything to make sure we're in thermal equilibrium using a temperature gradient instead of changing the temperature. And so then we just we let this sit for, you know, a day or so to equilibrate. And then we measure the temperature dependence by looking across here. Temperature is just distance. The model we have for the DNA, this I should really just pass through very quickly. The model we have essentially says there are many bonds on each of these. Typically, there are 40,000 DNAs on each of these particles. So the little thing where there are a couple there is really misleading. There are many, many here, okay? And a simple mean field approximation says I've got one here which can bind to K on the other surface. It can reach K other ones. There are NB of them in this binding area. That's the this is the start for the free energy. And if you use that simple theory and you change the coverage of the surface, you can measure and calculate what the melting temperature is. This is the fraction of unbound particles as a function of temperature, as a function of coverage. Yeah, so it fits really well. That's not so surprising. Okay. What's actually interesting here is the width of this melting curve is less than half a degree. You go from completely bound to completely unbound in less than half of a degree. Also, we have here 100% coverage, and over here we have 2.5% coverage. That means you can also put 40 different varieties of DNA on these particles and still have specific recognition, well controlled. And you can, of course, have this guy completely bound, while this guy is completely unbound. So you can really control things. You can also measure the kinetics of this. It turns out you can predict the kinetics sort of from a variation of DLA, where you have to put in the reaction time for your sticky ends. And the only thing we really don't know in this problem is this. We don't know, and we can't find reasonably in the literature, if two single strands come together, how long it takes, and you put them in a volume which is like their radius of gyration, how long it takes them to bind. Okay? The easiest estimation is like a rotational diffusion time, and it's like 3-4 orders of magnitude longer than that it takes. In any event, you can predict what the times are from one measurement of how long that reaction time is. I won't go through this stuff. The only thing I should mention, because Fred's here, is because Miriam did something really spectacular with this. Everybody told us that palindromes are really bad because they have hairpins. But in fact, the palindromes are really good because they have hairpins, because if you take a sample which has a palindrome on it, so a palindrome sticks to itself, right? It can fold over and stick to itself. You take it at high temperature, everything's open, everything's unbound. You quench it to low temperature. What happens immediately is the hairpins find each other and they bind. And that makes the particle inert. So it's now stabilized by itself. Now you bring two particles together and you hold them together, and now they'll stick. And so it's like some crazy glue or nano glue. And I won't show you the movies for this because I'm running out of time quickly. I'll just show you that if you make a strand like our seed over there and you use it with protected sticky ends, then 90 minutes later, it's still there and nothing else is bound to it. And if you do it with conventional sticky ends without the self-protection, you make a seed and in 10 minutes, it's a mess because it's aggregated. So this stuff works. Okay. Lock and key. I won't do very much with this. I'll just tell you that we stole this idea because we don't understand proteins. So if you read an elementary book, like a high school biology book, it tells you that proteins work by lock and key. So we believed it. So we said, okay, let's just make two surfaces which conform to one another. So the way to do that, this was the genius, it was done mostly in Dave Pine's group, and the genius that did it is Stefano over here, okay, who's a miraculous chemist, okay. What he did is he made an emulsion of this guy over here, this polymerize in water. This polymerizes two ways. You first polymerize the shell. Now you've got a rigid shell, it's like a tennis ball. You take a tennis ball, you stick a pump in it, and you suck the air out, and what happens? It buckles, right? So what happens when you polymerize the inside of this, it buckles, okay? And you can get particles that look like this. Depletion interaction, I won't go through here, I assume you guys know it, but essentially it depends on how much excluded volume you have between surfaces. Two flat surfaces are great. Two spheres are not so great, but if I have conformal surfaces so that one fits inside the other, I get a lot of volume inside that deplete and molecules can't fit in, which means that the pressure I have from the outside is not compensated inside, and these guys will stick together. And it works. And here it will work, and it will choose the particular size you want. Okay? You saw that particle suck in there. I hope you saw it. You'll see it again in a second. I want you to see this one because this is a great movie. Here you can see that lock just ate that key. You can see that particles bounce off it, right? They're attracted somewhat, but not sufficiently to stick, okay? And this movie is actually really great, as you'll see in a second. This is sort of hanging around there, okay? There you go. You guys see that? So what happens in this movie is, although the lock and key particles don't replicate yet, they have sex. Okay, which you see over there. Maybe next year, sex. So now let me just tell you about this, quickly, I hope. I'll tell you what does work. So we decided, so right now the problem is we're waiting for cinemate, We came up with the cinemate which cross-links, okay, but it turns out it's difficult to make, so making sufficient quantities to do it with the colloids isn't there yet. So in the meantime, we started working with Ned, well, we've always been working with Ned on this project, and the idea was to do exactly the same thing with DNA tiles as we were trying with the spheres, to make an A tile and a B tile, and A prime and a B prime have transverse interactions and longitudinal interactions, put them together and get it to work. Here's what the tiles look like. Each tile is a bend triple crossover. It's three double strands over here, intertwined, cross-linked with each other, with sticky ends coming out on that side and that side for the longitudinal interactions, and sticky ends coming down like this to bind with another tile underneath. That's the idea. Here's the actual structure. Each one of them is made from 9 strands of DNA. Okay? They self-assemble to make these tiles. If we want, we can put these hairpins on them so that you can read them. That is to say, they'll stick up. If we have one without this hairpin, in an AFM image, it will look flat. And if we have the hairpins on it, they will stick up and you can read it. We can also put biotin over here and then put streptavidin down on it and read that. We want to be able to distinguish an A tile from a B tile. Okay? And here is what happens to make the seeds. Now, the seeds here are the hard part, because the seeds, you can't take an AFM and assemble your word together. So for the seed to make here, each one of the tiles in the seed has to be made with a separate sticky end such that they'll line up in this particular sequence. 15? Oh, great. But that's including, well, I'm almost done anyway, because I sped up because I thought that that was right. Anyway, okay. So you assemble them. You assemble them. Each of these in the seed is specific. It forms this sequence, A, B, B, A, B, A, B, like that. You make this. In the case for the seeds, we had biotin instead of the hairpins. And what you do then is you put streptavidin on it. Streptavidin is actually lousy. It eats these things up, which is why the images here are lousy. But you can see that the sequence we wanted is identified easily. There's a bump, there's a bump, there's a bump, and the tiles are in between, right? So that's the seed. So you can tell that you've made the seed that you want. Now the question is, can you replicate it? Okay? So pretty much the process is the same. It's a little more laborious here because in order to see what you're doing, you have to separate the seed from the daughter, right? So you have to put on the end of your seed something which you can attach to a magnetic dynabead so you can pull it out so you're left with the daughter so you can see them, right? And you have to wash it and things like that in this case. So what you do is you make universal tiles. That is to say, instead of making a specific sequence, you make tiles here which can sit on anything. On your seed, you've got A, B, right? In the tiles, you've got, in the universal tiles, you've got A prime and B prime. You make these tiles first. You then introduce the seed. The tiles stick to the universal tiles stick to the seed. These guys, the B's, all have hairpins on them for identification. Before, the A ones had streptavidin on them for identification. Here it's the B ones we're looking at. You mix these together, okay? You separate, you wash it. You add a linker strand here because we don't have the cinemate yet, or we didn't at this time, okay? You pull this out, you heat it up, you separate them, and you look to see whether you've got a daughter. There are the daughters, right? And you can just read off, right? These are the B tiles labeled, so you can read off, you know, easily from the hairpins over here where they are. And the hairpins work much, much better, okay? So now we've made a replica. This guy is about 60% yield, which isn't great, right? But it's not so bad either. You get similar for the, you now take the daughters and you try and make granddaughters. Here you make universal tiles, which are the A's and B's instead of the A primes and B primes. You do the same thing. You add them to the daughters. Okay. Here what we've done is we've hairpinned the A tiles. Okay. You separate it out, and here are your daughters. And here the yield is from the initial seed to the daughters. It's not 36%. It's like 31%. So this is a system which actually does what we set out to do. It doesn't do it nice and fast and clean, but that's because we don't have the cinemate working yet. Hopefully we'll be able to do it with the cinemate and get this really so that all you do is cycle temperature and light. The cycle temperature and light. Here the cycle is much more laborious because we have to separate, okay, to do this. If you add the initial seeds back to the granddaughters, then you've got 1.3, okay, which means it'll take you about twice as long as if you doubled each time, right, with this, or slightly longer. But this could also exponentially grow. The way what's going to be done now is we have to do this with the cinemate here. If you do it with the cinemate, you don't have to separate, you don't have to have the washing steps. It should just go. I should say, the thing that's been done so far, the only thing we could find that's been done so far, which really is likes artificial self-replication, is this work by Lincoln and Joyce, which was a real breakthrough in 2009, where what they did is they got a molecule that will self-replicate itself. It's actually a ribosome. It's essentially a ribosome, so RNA enzyme, which has two pieces to it, a piece over here and this piece over here. Okay, it's self-enzymatic. This guy is a mirror of this guy, and this molecule will replicate itself and exponentially grow. And that's really an absolute breakthrough, right, in understanding RNA world, origin of life, stuff like that. But what it's doing is it's replicating a nucleic acid. It's not replicating something that's arbitrary, right? And it only replicates itself. It doesn't replicate in general. So I think the only thing, I mean, of course, this is really neat. It just goes on its own. So what we like to do is get something that works as nicely as this does, but in an arbitrary sense, right? Where you put in whatever word you want, whatever motif you want, and have it exponentially grow. And so we're almost there, but not quite. These are the replicating systems we're using. This guy, you know, also can be used. This guy can actually be used in a very neat way. Instead of having daughters here, you use these guys, the key particles, as daughters. You just make a string of locks over here. The keys act as daughters, but you don't cross-link them, and you directly make the copy. That's what we want to do with that. Okay, so I'm finished. I told you what I want to tell you, I think. And the only other thing I should say is the following. I always mention this because first time I gave this talk was at a Chemical Society meeting, and somebody said, what the hell are you talking about? This has nothing to do with self-replication. There's nothing to do with life. Has nothing. Nonsense. Complete nonsense. And before I had a chance to say anything, some guy in the back of the room said, well, you know, if you made this right, you could put it outside, right? Because every day, the temperature cycles and the sun comes up and goes down, right? And in the bio literature, I haven't found any reference to that. I mean, to the idea that the origin of life may be in this periodic drive. There is the idea of a periodic drive that waves come in flush and there's concentration, stuff like that. But the idea that the daily drive of both temperature and light might have something to do with things, I don't think is there. And I think it's kind of a natural way that you could do things. So that's where I want to leave it.
Please speak into the microphone. You mentioned yield. What about errors? What can you characterize the error rate?
That
the system that was getting 30% or whatever.
The 60%, okay, is everything else is errors of one form or another, if you want, right? I mean, it's either stuff that's not hybridized, or usually it's shorter, right? You note, by the way, of course, that mistakes here should replicate, right? And a big question is whether the all you need is the replication rate to be better than your mutation rate by some factor, not by a big factor either, and you win. Yes?
Could you clarify once more, how do you ensure that you cross-link along the chain but not between the chains?
It's different. The spacers here. Oops. Let me. Okay. Well, in either case, let me do it like this. Let me go back to here. There you go. So I want this. This palindrome and that palindrome are different. So that will not bind. This is a, let's say, that's a how have I arranged this here? That's supposed to be a unprimed sequence. These links here are different for A and B. So in order to form a bond here, a permanent bond, this sequence and that sequence have to match. And the sequence that matches here is different than the sequence that matches here. This is an A prime, is a prime palindrome. This is an unprime palindrome. Does that make any sense? You see it? In other words, suppose that I've got A prime over here with this sequence on it, and over here I've got this sequence, right? The cinemate is going to be in here. The crosslinker is going to be in here. This and that don't match, so they won't bind. So this won't bind to that, right? It won't bind permanently to that. It will bind temporarily through these guys, which are not permanent links, which are reversible, and the irreversible links, which are caused by the cinemate. Maybe it's better doing it like this. The irreversible bonds, which have the cinemate in them over here, these guys are also specific. So this one would be on the A chain, on, let's say, the seed, okay, and the granddaughter, right? And a different sequence would be on the daughters, right? So they don't cross-link. And I should say that it is a problem, but not with the cinemate. That's where we went with that. The problem we had when we first did this with the sorolin, which is what everybody told us to use, is it's not specific enough. So we had a seed of colloids. We have a daughter of colloids. We joined them together permanently, but we couldn't get them to separate because occasionally the sorolin would link between them. And that was enough. But this stuff, the cinemate, is much, much, much more specific.
But that means that the replica after that, the daughter of the replica will be again A, B, not prime, right?
Right, but it doesn't attach. The daughters don't attach. Daughters don't attach to daughters. Daughters don't attach to seeds. They only attach, I'm sorry, granddaughters. Granddaughters don't attach to seeds. Granddaughters don't attach to granddaughters. They have to alternate, right? Yeah.
Oh, just to ask you a brief question about this time, this reaction time that you said was four orders of magnitude off from your estimate, where you estimated as a rotational diffusion time. I'm just wondering if you did the same thing asking two colloids how long it takes for them to aggregate, and you calculated just a translational diffusion time, you get the wrong answer. That's like the Smoluchowski time. You have to do a different you have to calculate it differently. You have to calculate how long it takes for them to cover all the volume by rotational diffusion to ensure that two sides meet.
That's the Smoluchowski time. That's what we call the diffusion limited timeout here.
Right, right, right. But the same thing, you were asking about how long it takes for two molecules to come to interact, and you said you calculated by some rotational diffusion time.
Yeah.
It's not just rotational diffusion time, it's how long it takes two things to meet.
It's
more than that. You have to, because you have to have two things actually meet. So they can't just each rotational
diffusion. I should have said it differently. The time we did was like what you do for Smoluchowski, except for rotational diffusion. And it's way off. And the reason is, for lots of reasons that people know and some which seemingly they don't, one is simply they're charged. And so there's a big barrier. So this time actually depends a lot on the salt concentration. Also depends on divalent ions. Also depends on lots of other things. But it's also a question which people here know much better than I do of how, in fact, you actually want them to form. That is the simple picture. You know, my cartoon picture, everything to me is cartoon. Like the lock and key stuff, is that these guys come together, they find a reasonable point, and they zip up, right? And, you know, that's sort of true, and it's sort of not true, right? And the dynamics of that is hard. Only Shura might know that, and maybe Michael. Okay, but that's hard. In the event, what went in here was the for the colloid certainly was the yeah.
We're running out of time.
Paul, in a DNA world scenario, one important question is how long can you make a DNA before a error threshold kind of bounds you to a regime where things then have too many errors. So in your case, if you take your system, do you see a significant dependence on yield or error as you increase the length of your template?
Well, I'm sure we were. I'm sure we will. I'm sure it'll go exponential. But then we have to worry. I mean, the first step, I think, we want to do is get something that exponentially grows. And once we get that, then we can ask for error correction and stuff like that, which we have to do eventually, right? To get something that really works well. The first thing you want is you want a low error rate. That's going to depend exponentially on the length, as you say, right? Okay, so we're going to deal, we'll, once we get up to 100, we'll start worrying about it. First we want to get 7 going, okay? The question is really whether we can do it. But yeah, eventually there's the, what's it called, a catastrophe.
There might be different schemes than error correction.
There might be what?
Different schemes to avoid that instead of error correction. You might think of some cycles which then avoid the errors.
Right. Yeah. Sure, right. I mean, it's clear that error correction will be big once we get this going. But first you need a process, at least for a small number, that beats your errors. Which this one does already. Okay, thanks.
Good. I think we have to go on to the next speaker. Let's thank Paul Chaykin. The next speaker is Gijs Wijten from the Vrije Universiteit in Nederland. Quantifying the physics inside the genome one molecule at a time.